This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker. With me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Coronapocalypse is the headline on our latest Trumpet print edition, the May-June 2020 edition. We're wrapping work up on that now. And this issue has several articles about the madness taking place in the world today and giving a biblical perspective, God's perspective, on all that is happening. We have several items in this Week in Review radio program exploring more fallout from this virus and from nations' response to it. Before we get to those, we will start with a story about where the virus came from. More information is emerging about the origins of the coronavirus. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it's clear to everyone that the virus did originate in China. But what's interesting right now is that while the rest of the world is waging a war on the coronavirus and on their own economies, really, China is waging kind of a propaganda war to deflect blame away from Beijing for this outbreak. So you've got government spokespeople saying that anyone who dares to refer to the disease's Chinese origins is a racist. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Chinese state-controlled media just praising the Communist Party's governance and the handling of the coronavirus from the beginning to the present. They're just playing up how much time the Communist Party bought for the rest of the world, which is just, appalling. And then the most disturbing part of this propaganda campaign is high-ranking party members blaming the United States for bringing the coronavirus into China. So it's all just, an appalling bunch of nonsense. And the facts show that it really was the Chinese Communist Party's ineptitude and its dishonesty that unleashed this illness on the world. We now understand that in December of last year, the Communist Party began receiving warnings from medical authorities about this new influenza-like illness that didn't respond to conventional treatments that was emerging in the city of Wuhan. But rather than heed the warnings and take measures to contain the virus, CCP officials tried to ignore it and cover it up. They detained journalists who covered the story. They arrested citizens who posted about it online. They arrested doctors and even destroyed lab samples. So it was only in late January, after 7 weeks had passed, and after some 5 million potentially infected people had left Wuhan for other parts of the world, it was only at that time that the CCP began taking quarantine measures and alerting the world to this outbreak. We know from what we've seen of the spread of this illness in the U.S. and in certain European nations how much can change in just 1 week. So 7 weeks is an eternity here. And it all shows that the CCP, it tried to save face instead of saving lives. And it prioritized its own survival above that of the Chinese people or, the other peoples of the world. And China really is culpable for the virus's global spread, despite whatever they say in their propaganda.
The World Health Organization, Mr. Stephen Fleury, has been talking about the director general of the WHO and just how much he has been kind of carrying water for the Chinese communist government as well.
Great point. Yes, I think that every bit as appalling as the CCP's culpability and its subsequent propaganda is that the World Health Organization is complicit in both. From the outset, the WHO, an agency of the United Nations, has praised China's management of the disease. They've parroted Beijing's propaganda. They've turned a blind eye to China's lies and its ineptitude. And in mid-January, the WHO or the WHO reassured the world about Chinese studies showing that there was no evidence of person-to-person transmission. Then in February, it joined China in criticizing countries like the U.S. that imposed travel restrictions on China. They said, I've got a quote here from the Director General. It says, such restrictions unnecessarily interfere with international travel and trade. They can have the effect of increasing fear and stigma with little public health benefit. So, you know, we now know just how unbelievably wrong that was. This should be called the Chinese Health Organization, not the World Health Organization, because obviously they are utterly beholden to China and have acted as its lapdog in a lot of ways. And I think that if the WHO had spent less time kowtowing to China, less time sermonizing to the world about how we shouldn't refer to the disease's Chinese origins, and more time encouraging these kinds of measures that help contain the disease, then many lives could have been saved and much economic hardship avoided. But instead, the WHO served one of the world's most powerful and deplorable authoritarian regimes.
It is remarkable just looking at all of that information and then listening to the way that so many in the United States are continuing to insist that if you call it Wuhan or Chinese virus, or you make any kind of connection with where it originated, that in itself is racism. As you're looking at this, what sort of larger lessons do you take from this, and is there anything that's kind of biblically prophetic about the way that this is unfolding?
I think so. I think, to me, what I really see at play here is evidence of what happens when you give one strong man unbridled power over enough people. We've talked quite a lot about the rise of strongmen in this age, and Jesus Christ actually discussed that during his ministry on earth. He talked about the times of the Gentiles, an age that would come in shortly before his return, when instead of Israelitish nations such as the United States and Britain being the main global powers, the main stabilizers of the world, instead of that, there would be two main Gentile blocks that would rise up and become powerful. Mr. Gerald Flory wrote about this prophecy from Jesus Christ in our February 2020 print edition. It's an article called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And he really digs in deep to what Jesus Christ said there in Luke 21. And Mr. Flory says, these times of the Gentiles are yet to be fully realized. However, we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. So we know that this is coming soon, and I think that what we've seen in China with the Chinese Communist Party really just serving itself instead of its country, and Xi Jinping serving himself at all costs at the expense of global stability, that's the kind of thing that we can expect more and more of as this catastrophic storm kind of moves in.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Jeremiah has written an article about this specifically, the Chinese Communist Party's dishonesty and ineptitude unleashed the coronavirus on the world. You can find that at thetrumpet.com soon. And also we'll link to Mr. Flory's article, The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man, in the show notes for today's program. Now to Israel, what looks like a positive effect of coronavirus. Finally, a breakthrough in their efforts to form a government. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, a lot can change in a few days when it comes to Israeli politics. And it has been a bloodbath in terms of the back and forth, the biting, the backbiting, the intervention by the High Court onto Israel's political system to try and force a resolution as well, overstepping its bounds. And we talked about that on the Wednesday program. But on Thursday, yesterday, and today, we've finally got a breakthrough whereby, if you'll remember from Wednesday's program, there was meant to be a vote inside the Knesset to replace the Speaker of the House. The Speaker of the House is somebody that's allied with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, part of his Likud. And that vote to replace him was being pushed by Benny Gantz's Blue and White Party and endorsed by the High Court, the Supreme Court of Israel, basically, to ensure that there could be another Speaker of the House and there could be some laws that come forward to basically forbid Netanyahu from going forward to becoming the Prime Minister. And what happened was the Speaker of the House decided I cannot on good conscience go forward with this vote to replace myself because the High Court has no jurisdiction over the legislature. And so he resigned. And at that point, it looks like Benny Gantz decided that there, because he resigned and because it looked increasingly like he was going to be unable to receive 61 people in the Knesset to back those potential laws to then ensure Netanyahu wouldn't be in power, he decided that enough is enough. The only solution out of this, well, there'll be two solutions. One is to go to a fourth election and re-vote everyone and vote all again, which no Israeli wants, or to join Netanyahu himself. And so that is what has happened. Benny Gantz, leader of the Blue and White Coalition, and it's a Blue and White party, has broken up. He has taken with him the 15 seats of his Israel Resilience Party, broken off from Yair Lapid's Yesh Atid party and the other members, or two other members of his Blue and White party. So that has split. The other two members have decided to be in the opposition, and Benny Gantz has decided to join forces with Netanyahu, saying that with the coronavirus, this is no time to go to a fourth election. We have to have a functioning government, even if that means I have to break my campaign promise to never sit inside of a government of Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm going to do exactly that. And so his party's broken up. Netanyahu's government or coalition now looks like it will have 75 seats, which is past the 61 needed to have a majority in the Knesset. And that, of course, would include 15 of the seats of Benny Gantz's party, not Blue and White, but his smaller subdivision of Blue and White, the Israel Resilience Party.
Quite an amazing development. It was just on Wednesday that we were talking about just how much Benny Gantz and the Blue and Whites were risking politically by allying themselves with these Arab parties. It looks like under pressure from quite a few. You were talking about some MKs who said that they couldn't go along with this. Certainly, he was getting a lot of chirping in his ear about just how unprincipled this move was. It seems like he's finally succumbed to some of that. Good news for Israel. Good news for Netanyahu.
Yeah, under what looks like the deal that's going to take place is Netanyahu would become the prime minister for the next 18 months, and then potentially Benny Gantz would become prime minister after 18 months. We'll see how this all shakes down. Some of Benny Gantz's party will get some ministerial roles, defense minister, foreign minister at first, something like that. But we'll see how this plays out. There's, of course, the media here, it's just really hard to find out who to believe, really. But it looks like Benny Gantz was really facing a losing proposition. If he understood well enough, and there was polls that came out, internal polls, that if he did go to the fourth election, since the cover was blown of their desire, or at least their willingness to side with the Arab parties to remove Netanyahu, that most of the Blue and White support was going to be lost in the fourth election. So had it gone to a fourth election, Benny Gantz's party would have suffered, and perhaps they would have broken up anyway. And so he decided that it was good for Israel, but I think it's actually good for his future as well. If he's going to come out and say, hey, everyone, we're facing this climactic apocalyptic crisis as it is being pushed on the Israeli public, I'm willing to, you know, put my own personal ambition and my hatred of Netanyahu to the side so that we can have a functioning government to deal with that. Plenty in the media are saying that's a horrible decision. He lied. He's going, you know, and he shouldn't have fallen for Netanyahu. But there's probably plenty of Israelis that are looking at that saying, okay, that's a decent idea. That's a principled idea. And so he might actually come out okay going forward. His political future is going to – he is going to have a political future. So it looks like, bottom line – I think on Wednesday's program, I gave this eventuality a 25% chance. I said fourth elections were 50%. This unity government's 25% chance, and that's what's happened. And it means that Israel is going to have a government and Netanyahu is going to be the prime minister for the next 18 months at least.
Yeah. Pretty remarkable that the press would view Gantz allying with Netanyahu as less principled than allying with those Arab parties.
Well, I do think what happened on Thursday was a stunning turnaround from what it looked like was going to happen. Mm. The press was all in on this idea of ousting Netanyahu, and he looked beleaguered and looked like he didn't have too many options as far as the press reporting. And then it comes out that he's going to be the prime minister for the next 18 months, and Benny Gantz, his arch adversary, is joining him. And mm-hmm. now Trump and Netanyahu can come together to work together for the next 18 months on this peace deal, as Mr. Trump wants to put in place. And so it was really a surreal moment. And you look at the front pages of Israeli media today, and it's all corona still. Mm. And yet yesterday, the day before, it was a lot of it was about Netanyahu and how Netanyahu needs to go. Hmm. But it's now like they've already moved on, the media has, because they're not victorious in this. They wanted Netanyahu gone, and they wanted Gantz to be prime minister, but it just hasn't happened. And really, I think Israelis are probably breathing a sigh of relief today that they actually have a government, and have a government that can work with the president of the United States.
Well, there was something about this whole thing as it was unfolding, just given the political trends in the United States and Britain, that I think all of us have had a certain amount of a sense that Netanyahu would emerge from this just fine. And so it looks like that's exactly what has happened. We appreciate that very much, Brent. We'll go now to the UK, where our correspondent Richard Palmer is under intense surveillance by the newly authoritarian British government. Tell us about it, Richard.
Yes, I think this story really follows right on from what you heard from Jeremiah. I think when we look back at the impact coronavirus had on the world, one of the biggest impacts is going to be a massive shift towards authoritarianism. China propping up their authoritarian government and trying to promote that. But then in the UK and a lot of these countries that you typically think of as being much more freedom-loving, we've had some incredibly draconian measures put in place here in the UK, measures that fundamentally change the individual's relation with the state. Changes that go completely against Britain's tradition of common law, of freedom, of human rights, that fundamentally undermine core pieces of the English Constitution, changes that are fundamentally lawless. And basically, right now, we're pretty close to being a fascist state here in the United Kingdom. The government dominates the economy. Huge numbers, maybe even most workers, are now on the government payroll. Public gatherings are banned. You're not even allowed to meet with two people outside. I think someone sardonically observed that even the Greek colonels allowed three people to get together, but that's now banned. I think the only thing missing from a textbook definition for fascism is ultra-nationalism pushed by the government. So we're very close to being a fascist state, and it's been a real revelation to me just how quickly we can emerge in this position and how willing people are to go along with it. I don't think I ever thought we could be in this position, and that we'd be in this position with most people applauding. Mm-hmm. That these liberties that people have fought for, this is the anniversary today, I think, of the accession of Charles I, who had his head chopped off for taking away liberties, exactly the same kind of liberties that we see under assault today. But we are fine with that. I think if you go back and look at the way England has treated common law in the past, this would have been regarded as illegal, unconstitutional, and all laws null and void. So Edward Coke, he was a key figure in the development of English law, a former chief justice. He said the ancient and excellent laws of England are the birthright and most ancient and best inheritance that the subjects of this realm has. And he talked about how common law includes common rights, including common rights to leave your house without having to ask permission from Her Majesty's government. And he said the common law will control acts of parliament and sometimes adjudge them utterly void, for when an act of parliament is against common right and reason or repugnant or impossible to be performed, the common law will control it and adjudge such acts to be void. And it was his ruling there that played a role, for example, in this infamous stamp duty being outlawed that was leveled on the United States in the run-up to the revolution there. So fundamental English liberties being completely ignored. And then since that came into place on Monday, you've had the police behaving in very disturbing ways, posting, having hotlines and websites for people to report their neighbors for leaving their house without good reason, just like we're in the German Democratic Republic and they're the Stasi. You've had the police using drones or helicopters to measure how far people are leaving their houses. These are things that, like I said, I never thought could happen in a free country, and I never thought people would willingly go along with it. I thought you would have riots in the streets before you had something like this. But we'll have riots in the streets over climate change, but nobody seems to care when it comes to ancient liberties that have been an Englishman's birthright for hundreds of years.
This is very interesting, because for so long the trend has been against government. The trend has been toward lawlessness. You have so many on the left in particular, they're celebrating groups like Antifa and protest movements, and they just praise those who resist government. And now suddenly you have the government, and in many cases it's more leftist governors who are issuing these kinds of orders and diktats, and they're expecting full compliance from the public. Stephen Fleury played a quote on Trumpet Daily Radio show the other day of Andrew Cuomo, the New York governor, who he said that he was walking around the streets of New York and people were just moving around like there was nothing wrong. There were far too many people on the streets. He says it's totally inappropriate, and haven't I been clear enough that I said that you need to stay at home? This is not a joke. He was just very upset that people weren't kind of clicking their boot heels and saluting and doing exactly what they were told. It's a very strange expectation given the way that they've been handling themselves for so long. But what you're talking about, what's happening here in Britain, it reminds me of the article that you had not that long ago, that article about trusting government, how this is really the most important lesson that we can learn, that we have to be careful. The amount of trust that we have put in our government, we've been coming to depend on them more and more and more, and we trust them to bail us out of every crisis. Well, now we're seeing the flip side of that trend. If you surrender that much of your trust into the government's hands, in a sense, you're empowering them to turn and to use that power against you.
Yes, but I think, there's still something very simple that has changed that is not going to go away after all of this. Before Monday, freedom in Britain was a sacred principle. It's what we sang our songs about, that we'd never, never, never give up our rights and our liberties. And it seemed like that was something very hard to take away. After Monday, it's very clear we don't care about freedom and we will surrender that willingly. Before Monday, the police protected liberty. Afterwards, after Monday, they threaten liberty. We're saved only from being a police state that there's just not enough police to act like one. Before Monday, freedom was our birthright. After Monday, freedom is something that the freedom to go outside of our front door is something that we need to ask the government for, something that it has never been in all of history. So I think there's some long-term consequences from this. I mean, obviously, we're not going to be under house arrest in the UK forever. But it's now become patently obvious to anyone, to any politician, that these freedoms are actually a lot easier to take away than ever before. And I thought that this tradition that we had and the way that Englishmen had acted in the past, that this were a much greater barrier to tyranny. And I'm having to realize, well, no, it's not. Mm-hmm. This has really woken me up to a reality that Mr. Fleury talks about in the America Under Attack booklet, that Britain and America have been blessed by God, and the freedom that we've had and the freedom from tyranny and the restrictions on government tyranny are things that we've had because of a blessing from God. And it's not just, that's not normal. That's not just the way it is. But because we've had those blessings, it's just so easy to take it for granted. And I'm realizing now I've taken that freedom that we have here in the UK for granted, or thought that it was about something special within the English or within our constitution and our history. And there's a little truth in that, but really that freedom is there because of blessings. And as those blessings are going to be are being removed, that freedom is being removed. Mm-hmm. And we might kind of think that, and I think that that's impossible. And obviously I've read those quotes that Mr. Flurry talks about in America Under Attack, and I've agreed with them, but still on some level, I don't think it's sunk in before about how real it is that those freedoms can be taken away, will be taken away. You can see how much easier it's going to be for there to be this kind of emergency control put in place. We had Parliament pass what's basically an enabling act just this week that takes away a whole bunch more freedom, puts in place government control on mobile phones and things like that. And we saw, you know, after 9/11, a whole bunch of temporary constraints on freedom that were put in place, and FISA court procedures and things like that, that are in place still today. So I think our freedom from tyranny has taken a monumental blow. And that's a trend that is just going to get worse in Britain and America. And that's something that Mr. Flurry talks about in that book, America Under Attack. And there's a spiritual reality behind that attack. And we're going to see some real changes over time in Britain and America. And that freedom that we have isn't something that we can take for granted.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. We do have the trumpet brief that Richard wrote on this very subject up on the website right now. Your freedom is more fragile than you think. We'll link to that in the show notes, and also Gerald Flurry's booklet, America Under Attack. In our newest trumpet issue, which we are wrapping up now, we have several articles trying to give God's perspective on coronavirus. Well, there are others trying to give God's perspective as well, and they're arriving at quite different conclusions than we are. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest differences between the Obama administration and the Trump administration, is kind of the attitude that Inner Circle has shown towards the Bible, with the Obama administration going so far as banning military chaplains from even posting scriptures or talking about scriptures unless they're in a private counseling session. And the Trump administration actually holding weekly Bible studies in the White House with Vice President Mike Pence and quite a few of the higher-ranking cabinet members. And usually those studies, they go out without much fanfare. But there was a study given last week that apparently struck a chord because it's been in the headlines. And it was titled, Is God Judging America Today? And all the media sources that I've seen reporting on this study are accusing this evangelical minister who does these studies for the Trump administration of blaming coronavirus on homosexuality and environmentalists. They're saying God is wrathful at the homosexuals and God is wrathful at the environmentalist, and he's punishing America for that, which, as you'd expect or come to expect from mainstream media sources, is a pretty gross twisting of what this minister actually said. The headline was dramatic enough that I downloaded the Bible study and just quickly read through it. And this minister for the Trump administration, he was going through the first half of this about three types of divine wrath. He had what he called cataclysmic wrath, where God curses a nation; forsaking wrath, where God withdraws his protection from a nation; and consequential wrath, which is basically just cause and effect. You reap what you sow. Now, he cited, going through Romans 1, homosexuality and nature worship as sins that will cause God to forsake an individual. He's just using those as an example and quoting the Bible. It says, like, if you practice these sins, God will forsake you. But he didn't link it with coronavirus. In fact, he went so far as to say, he's like, no, coronavirus is completely consequential wrath. It's just cause and effect. It's the Chinese did some bad, corrupt stuff that Jeremiah was talking about earlier in the program, and there's been ripple effects. And now, as anyone who's been following this program will know, that's not quite what the Bible says. Zechariah 6, Matthew 24, Revelation 6, all talk about God sending plagues and pestilence as a curse on nations. So it is. There's definitely some cause and effect in there, but there's also definitely these angelic beings that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, talks about in his article that we'll put in the show notes, coronavirus and other plagues in prophecy. And so that does show that God does actually have an active hand in this. Scripture's not brought up, in this Bible study. But the other really interesting point I found is that in direct opposition to how the mainstream media reported this, when this minister in the Trump administration got to the conclusion of his Bible study, he not only didn't say that homosexuality was the cause of coronavirus, he actually said that God does not actively curse nations in the church age, and went beyond that, saying that, like, well, you know that God would never curse America because he told Abraham he wouldn't curse Sodom and Gomorrah if he could find 10 good people. And there's tens of millions of Christians in the United States. And I'm sure a lot of people, think that. But this is another verse that didn't come up here, is God had that, he did have this rhetorical deal with Abraham. He's like, well, I'll spare Sodom and Gomorrah for 10 good people. But it's not like God didn't know there weren't 10 good people in Sodom and Gomorrah. But for those who say that, like, well, God will spare America for a few good people, Ezekiel actually, apparently they must have been saying that in his day, because the prophet Ezekiel covers that exact point in Ezekiel 14. Where Ezekiel 14 and verse 14, he says, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver their own souls by their righteousness, says the Lord God. And then a little later in that chapter, God's explaining, he said, I won't even save son or daughter for the righteousness of the father. So saying, it's like when this curses come on the nation, he's like, God's like, I'll protect individuals who seek me, but not even their not even their immediate families, much less the nation they're living in. So he's saying, each person has to be developing, like I said, the righteousness of Daniel, or so it's like Noah, Job, and Daniel. These are apparently like the three, some of the three most righteous people you can think of throughout history. But you have to be working towards that and developing that. And another book we can put in the show notes is from our editor-in-chief, Daniel Unsealed at Last, that will delve quite a bit into what Daniel believed and the type of righteousness he was developing, that can show people that if you're working towards that goal, God will protect individuals. But you can't just take it for granted that because you go to church once a week, or you have your dad goes to church once a week, that you're going to be protected because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting how there was actually an article about how you have environmentalists out there who are saying that coronavirus is actually punishment from Mother Nature for global warming. There's this kind of idea that, and I don't think there would be a lot of people who would look at that and say, well, come on, that's ridiculous. But for anyone to suggest that sin is causing coronavirus, or to actually make an explicit connection between homosexuality or of those types of sins and a disease like this, is absolutely pilloried and excoriated. This would be just shouted down by people in public. And yet, and so you have these religious leaders who are out there trying to give answers to people who are asking questions. Why is this happening? And they're trying to explain how sin has nothing to do with it. There are quite a few of them who are making statements similar to the ones that you're describing from this White House minister. What's interesting is how many times in the Bible it specifically says to watch out for prophets who are saying that everything is just fine, that your sins aren't causing this, when in fact your sins are causing this, when in fact you are suffering curses for sin. There are a lot of places in the Bible that warn against false prophets.
Right. Even the verse we just talked about in Ezekiel about Noah, Daniel, or Job, it doesn't necessarily give the backstory of what prompted God to deliver that particular bit of advice through Ezekiel. But it definitely would seem like people were saying exactly what some people today are saying. It's like, well, God's not gonna send a nation into captivity because of all these good people in here, and you have to like debunk that. Like, no, it's like Daniel, Noah, or Job could have saved themselves, or I would have protected them because they follow me. But you can't extrapolate that to the people around them. And then, you know, Isaiah and Amos are filled with verses about people who they look to prophets who prophesy smooth things, and so they are prophesying. Mm-hmm. But they're prophesying smooth things, so they pretend like they're speaking for God.
Mm-hmm.
Or sincerely believe they're speaking for God in some cases, but they ignore those verses that are sometimes not so pleasant to think about.
Right. And many prophecies about national punishment that is coming. So you have to ignore a whole lot of prophecies in order to make those kinds of conclusions. We thank you for that, Andrew. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break, but I want to encourage you to tune into our special Trumpet Radio presentation tomorrow, Saturday at 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, will host a special Trumpet Daily Radio show live. Last week, Stephen Flurry did an hour-and-a-half presentation, and this week, Gerald Flurry will give one. He'll give us needed perspective on the tumultuous events that we're witnessing in the world today. You'll be able to listen to it at thetrumpet.com or watch it at The Trumpet's YouTube channel. There'll be a link there on the front page of The Trumpet. Be sure to tune in tomorrow, 9 a.m. CDT. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of The Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Coronavirus concerns caused the United States to cancel some war games it had planned within Europe. But one nation is not canceling its war games. It's proceeding full speed ahead. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the U.S. did postpone some games, as you said, because of disruptions that have happened because of this coronavirus scare. But Russia has charged full steam ahead with its own set of war games in Europe. This week, the Russian military has deployed 1,500 paratroopers, along with artillery forces, to Crimea. The artillery forces here include Grad, multiple-launch rocket systems. They also have self-propelled howitzers, D-30 howitzers, Nona-S self-propelled artillery guns, and just a whole array of mortar systems as well. And then they have 15 of Russia's 276 military transport planes taking part in these games. They have about 20 fixed-wing and rotary-wing aircraft. Those are mostly reconnaissance planes, and then also 24M frontline bombers, Su-30 SM multitask fighter jets. And they're all there practicing for rapid deployment of aircraft for bombing campaigns and for air support in the event of conflicts at sea or on land. So it's just a massive set of war games that Russia has going on in Crimea, and they're supposed to last until the end of the month. And there's an analysis from Task and Purpose that makes a good point. It says, while Russia has held military exercises on the Crimean Peninsula before, it's never attempted them during a global pandemic that's forced militaries around the world to reorient themselves toward containing the spread of COVID-19 at home. So, you know, Russia still appears to have not been hit nearly as hard by this virus as other nations, at least so far. And it hasn't given in to the kind of fears that have made other nations kind of shut down and tank their economies. And now Russia seems like it's really using this as an opportunity to show the world that while everyone else is reeling and panicking, Russia is still composed and they're over there practicing for war.
We talk a lot about just how much this type of activity by Russia panics Europe, how concerned they are. And you would think that given the circumstances, this would double or triple the level of concern within European nations.
That's a great point. Yes, ever since Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine back in 2014, Russia's been just strengthening its military presence there and demonstrating that presence to Europe and to the world as often as it can. And that really does have many Europeans on edge because that's, you know, it's their backyard. And many of the weapons that the Russians are using have much or most of Europe well within range. So it's not hard to see why all these kinds of drills and these demonstrations of aggression would be unsettling to the Europeans. And right now, with so many in Europe already fearful over the coronavirus, those fears, I think, of Russia's militarism could just add to the anxiety that much more.
We do have an article by Mr. Fleury, The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe, that talks specifically about how the Bible prophesies of European fear related to Russia's war-making endeavors, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. Keep an eye on what happens with these war games there in Crimea from Russia. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. We spoke in the first half about Britain taking authoritarian measures to combat this virus. It isn't the only nation to do so. We're seeing other European leaders and other leaders elsewhere use this opportunity to grab more power. To tell us what's happening in Hungary, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this really is a trend that is hitting all of the European Union. And we spoke about some of that last week. What I thought I'd do today, rather than kind of dip into one country after another, is just look at one of the worst offenders here. And it's a powerful demonstration of just how quickly Europe can be transformed in an emergency. So this worst example is Hungary under its Prime Minister Viktor Orban. They're already a fairly authoritarian country anyway. Mr. Orban has accumulated a lot of powers, but he's using this coronavirus to put forward quite an extraordinary bill, one that people fear would fundamentally turn Hungary from a democracy to a dictatorship, that we could be about to witness a European EU member country kind of going full on Vladimir Putin. So they're putting forward, Mr. Orban declared a state of emergency on March 11. And then he's putting forward a bill that extends that state of emergency indefinitely. So this bill would allow him to rule by decree without parliament. He would have unchecked power with no sell-by date on that. It's still going through Hungary's political system. It would require a two-thirds majority to pass, but his party does dominate the system right now. So you could get the point that you could get to this point. People are already talking about the EU's first dictatorship. And, you know, well, how does the European Union deal with this if one of their members becomes a dictatorship? But what I think is really interesting about this, beyond just Hungary, is, you know, on this show, we talk a lot about the future of Europe. And we talk a lot about the rise of a European strongman, that this strongman is going to be an authoritarian leader. You know, Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11, you know, Daniel 8 talks about him being a fierce king, and you know, he's an authoritarian. Other parts of the Bible talk about a very religious future coming to Europe, one where working on Sunday, for example, is completely forbidden. And there's a form of religion and worship that's required this on Sunday. So you're looking at a very different direction for Europe. And we just saw how one country in Europe can kind of have that change in direction just like that. Mm-hmm. That Hungary is, I mean, whether they remain a democracy, a dictatorship, whether they go back to being a democracy, you know, that's basically up to Mr. Orban now. If he wants to, if this law goes through, he'd pretty much be able to keep Hungary as a dictatorship now. And so it's just like the story I talked about in the first half. I think it's incredibly revealing just to see how fast these things can change. And I think it's you know, if you keep those in mind, what the Bible says about Europe is very believable if you look at what we're seeing now. I mean, this is in response to a coronavirus, but what about things like mass terrorism, war in the Middle East, a serious threat from Russia, like Jeremiah has talked a bit about, and Russia kind of moving into Europe, any kind of those emergencies that's on a scale even bigger than coronavirus. This has given us a glimpse into just how a modern Western European, well, I guess Hungary is technically not in the West, but still a European state that's part of the European Union can become a dictatorship. It's a really powerful warning for us that these forecasts that we're making could be fulfilled really quickly.
Mm. Stunning stuff. We appreciate you bringing that to us very much, Richard. Moving over to America now, to help Americans deal with the effects of coronavirus, this week Congress passed the largest spending measure in human history. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, on Wednesday, the Senate unanimously approved a stimulus bill for $2 trillion to help deal with the effects of the coronavirus. Now, this passed 96-0. There were four senators absent, but complete bipartisanship, which is probably the most amazing thing about this bill. It's hard to get the Senate or Congress to agree on anything other than spend more money. The Republicans were actually really, really pleased with it. The Democrats were slightly upset, or maybe more than slightly upset, at how small $2 trillion is for this stimulus. But it's going to be spread out amongst a lot of different places. Some of it's going to go to business. Some of it's going to go to unemployment insurance. Probably the part that's getting the most attention is just monetary handouts to individuals. I think they're handing out $1,200 for a single person, and then that goes up more for those with families. So it's that's what I'm most excited about with this bill, is I think I qualify for the $1,200, so I can pocket that as I sally forth into the end of Western civilization. But it's
well, considering just how indebted these countries already are, to rack up this much additional debt because of a crisis like this, it really is extremely troubling.
Right, because I did a short write up for the Society Watch section of, I think it was the last issue of the print edition or the edition before that, just talking about how damaging to America it was that we were going to run a $1 trillion deficit this year. And that $1 trillion deficit was before
pre-coronavirus.
They announced $2 trillion more in coronavirus stimulus. It's actually the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He's talking like this is a war move. He says a fight has arrived on our shores. We did not seek it. We did not want it. But now we're going to win it. And talking about this investment. So, I mean, this is like Winston Churchill style rhetoric over 1,000 people who have died of the flu. I did some back of the envelope calculations. I think on average 21,000 people die every year of America and the flu. So the 1,000 who've died of coronavirus so far, I mean, the numbers are going up, but it basically means so far this flu season's about 5% worse than usual. It's always bad when you have a bad flu season, but it's your taking financial measures you haven't seen since the Great Recession and using war rhetoric you haven't heard since World War II, to talk about like mobilizing all national resources to get the just taking your blow up your debt to combat this this slightly worse than usual flu season.
In our upcoming Trumpet edition, Richard Palmer has an article called "Can the Global Economy Recover?" Just talking about how long the effects of this virus, after everything blows over physically, we're still going to be saddled with these tremendous debt loads that we've incurred in an effort to combat not just the virus, but the effects of the lockdowns and the response to the virus. So you can watch for that article coming up in that coming Trumpet edition. Thank you for that, Andrew. We'll finish the program with a non-coronavirus story, more evidence of just how strong and far-reaching Iran's power in the Middle East is, in spite of the setbacks it has experienced recently. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Last month, Saudi Arabia was flying a jet. This is a warplane over Yemen targeting the Houthis, and the Houthis are the Iranian-backed group that work in northwestern Yemen, mainly in those places. And it was shot out of the sky, and one of the pilots survived, and he's currently held captive by the Houthis, as is a number of other soldiers that belong to Saudi Arabia. Now, what happened this week is something very interesting, and it hasn't happened before, is that the Houthis offered a prisoner exchange, whereas Saudi Arabia would get their prisoners back. But instead of the Houthis getting prisoners, their people back from Saudi Arabia, instead, the Houthis requested that the dozens of Hamas members that are now being held by Saudi Arabia, but that they be released. And this is stunning because Hamas has absolutely nothing to do with the Houthis, apart from the fact that both the Houthis and Hamas are funded, controlled, weaponized, all whatever you want to call it, by Iran. They both answer to Iran. And so this is it's interesting because if you go back to 2015, 2016, when the Yemen war was really starting up and you had the Houthis against the Saudis, the Obama administration went to extreme lengths to say that there was absolutely no connection between Iran and the Houthis. And here we are now in 2020. It's absolutely it's absolutely obvious to anyone now that Iranians are not trying to hide it, that the Houthis are now requesting Hamas operatives to be released and for the sake at the behest of Iran, no doubt. And so this is something I think is just going to really just show people how much Iran does have proxy forces all over the Middle East. And it is now using them together as one collective organization, not even trying to hide the fact that they all answer to the Ayatollah.
Thank you for that, Brent. We will link to an article from our editor-in-chief from a few years back. Iran gets a stranglehold on the Middle East. We've been tracking its activities throughout the region for quite some time in fulfilling its biblically prophesied role of the King of the South. Go check that article out. Thank you for that, Brent. I'm Joel Hilliker. That is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of G.K. Chesterton. I do not believe in a fate that falls on men however they act, but I do believe in a fate that falls on them unless they act. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.